Hello and welcome to the Central Asian Podcast Majlis. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and host of the Majlis. One more year has just passed, and it was quite a year in Central Asia. On one hand, some countries struggled to maintain effect of shrinking Russian economy, decreasing price of energy, migrant crisis, devaluation of national currencies. On the other hand, security and terrorism. Effect of those events varied country to country, and its short and long-term consequences will also depend on country to country. In this episode of Majlis, in-house panel will discuss main highlights of the year and events that leading us to 2016. Joining me in the discussion is Sojida Jafarova. She is director of the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Tajik service. Winira Jumataeva, director of RFRL's Kyrgyz service. Sirajitin Tolibov, broadcaster in Uzbek service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. And from Central Newsroom, Bruce Panier is joining us, who is the editor of RFRL's Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us in today's show.
Thank you.
We will talk about our individual countries in details. First, Bruce, let me come to you. You are diving deep in all Central Asia in all of these regional issues. So what has been the main highlights, major developments of 2015 in the region?
Highlights, I wouldn't say. I would consider it more lowlights. And you touched on some of these subjects in your introduction, that we have across the board, there's been economic decline in Central Asia, and for different reasons. For the hydrocarbon exporters, and by that I mean Kazakhstan, the oil exporter, and Turkmenistan, a gas exporter, of course, there's been a hard hit that they've taken from the falling prices of hydrocarbons on world markets. At the same time, no one in Central Asia was immune to these problems because we have a lot of migrant workers that come from the other three countries, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, and we know that the Russian economy has been ailing too, so that we've seen figures coming out of Russia's central bank that seem to support the fact that remittances are falling, going back to these countries, and that's remembering that Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are among the most remittance-dependent countries in the world, and in some cases it's fallen by nearly half. Kyrgyzstan, not so bad, but in Tajikistan's case and Uzbekistan's case, I think it's well over 40% at this point that has fallen from the year before. In addition to that, we've had another problem too, that the normally peaceful and quiet northern part of Afghanistan has suddenly exploded, and we have all kinds of problems up there too. So at the same time that we have economic problems in Central Asia that they're trying to deal with, there's also a new security concern along the southern border with Afghanistan. And that, of course, is in addition to the fact that the Islamic State militant group has been trying to recruit people from Central Asia. Most of those to date have been migrant laborers, but in fact they're trying to reach out into Central Asia and see if they can't get more people, and there's some evidence that it's having an effect.
Right. Sajida, let's go to you. If you look back to 2015, what would you consider three main developments in your country, in Tajikistan?
2015 was an eventful year in different areas in Tajikistan. I would highlight first parliamentary elections in Tajikistan, and which deprived two major opposition parties from seats in the parliament. Communist Party and Islamic Party. And I would highlight also government's huge propaganda against ISIS all over the country, which brought some success. And less people joined ISIS in the recent few months. I can't avoid talking about General Gulmurat Halimov, the chief of police from Tajikistan, who joined ISIS in May 2015. And, of course, the main event that somehow changed a government's policy towards domestic issues and foreign policy, this is the September rebellion conducted by the Deputy Defense Minister Nazarzoda, who attacked several facilities in Tajikistan, and several dozens of people from both sides were killed. So those are the main events that I believe would have effect in the future in 2016.
Would you consider the remittances the crisis in Russia.
Definitely. What I mentioned, it's basically a security issue in terms of remittances. I think Tajikistan hits more than the other countries around Central Asia because Tajikistan does not have diversified economy. Right. And the country basically relies on migrants' remittances. Crisis in Russia and drop of migrants' remittances by almost 50% definitely had a huge effect on people's life, on economy, on companies working in Tajikistan, and devaluation of national currency. So yes, it has a huge effect.
And Venera, what about your country?
Oh, it was a big political testimony in Kyrgyzstan for parliamentary democracy, for young parliamentary system in Kyrgyzstan, which only exists in Central Asia so far. And it seems, according to international and domestic observers, that Kyrgyzstan passed this political test successfully.
Yeah.
They all estimated or evaluated this last parliamentary elections in 2015 in October 4th. As political campaign held in a fair, free, and competitive manner. Even though we had lots of shortcomings, we escorted these parliamentary elections, like around 1 million people, eligible voters, were not able to vote because of complicated new biometric system of registration of voters. Versus 1 million people, apparently many of them, a majority of them, are living abroad in Russia, Kazakhstan, and other foreign countries. And they, I believe, at least half of them have already two passports on their hands, and they're afraid of officially registering or submitting their biometric data to Kyrgyz authorities because they're afraid that the Russian new government or new authorities will realize that they are being politically active in their historical homeland, etc. So it is said that Kyrgyzstan is officially losing this part of its population, but the latest parliamentary elections became a new proof that Kyrgyzstan will maintain this political direction of building parliamentary democracy in the country. At least they showed their intention, political will. And so we have now the most diverse parliament in Kyrgyzstan, politically diverse, I mean, which is built up from six political parties. Unfortunately, they are not diverse from their like political views or ideological platform. As many stories, including RFL stories, told people that almost all six political parties are very pro-Russian and very, let's say, have very similar views on many, many issues. And, of course, second big political big historical turn for the country was joining Eurasian Economic Union, which turned country closer toward Russia. And as many observers, including Bruce Panier and other colleagues, say, Kyrgyzstan is a paradoxical country which is trying to build only parliamentary democracy in the region, but also moving to the Russia's embrace or Russia's orbit much closer than any other country in the region. So will Kyrgyzstan survive as a parliamentary democracy in coming years? Every year, the political stability is a big issue for Kyrgyzstan. So last year, everybody was talking, will political stability survive in the country where big political parliamentary elections are coming? So now Kyrgyz authorities are saying that their biggest achievement is maintaining political stability in the country. So every time, every year, it is a big test for authorities. So it's paradoxical country. Joining Eurasian Economic Union turned out to be negative story for the country so far. People are facing lots of economic hardship in their everyday life. Even though we say remittances from Kyrgyz migrants abroad fell by around 30%, but... And also national currency, Kyrgyz soms devaluation hit around 30%. But in everyday life, people are facing much bigger problems. Prices jumped up much higher than 30%. It is around 50%. Livestock prices, which is most important thing for Kyrgyz farmers and many Kyrgyz people, they jumped up higher than 50%. And so around half of construction companies are facing bankruptcy, and garment factories, Kyrgyz small factories, were providing by clothes, almost all region and part of Russia, Siberian part of Russia, they are around 40% of them are facing closure of their business. And so life is becoming harder and harder for people in Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan lost around 30% of their trade relations with CIS countries, first of all, including Russia, Kazakhstan, etc. So it means, in general, the economic situation is getting worse by every day.
All right, Bruce, you want to jump in?
Yeah, if I just could ask you a question too, Venera, about security, that although there have been arrests of people across Central Asia who the governments there say were linked to the Islamic State militant group, Kyrgyzstan is the only country among the five where there's actually been active security operations in which people have been killed. Three, I think, where the government, without providing a whole lot of evidence, said that this was somehow connected to militant groups outside the country, two following jailbreaks and then a more recent one that they had there. How is the security situation in Kyrgyzstan with that understanding that this is the only place where we've actually seen people killed this year during these security sweeps?
We know that Kyrgyzstan was following some much more freedom, religious freedom policy compared to neighboring countries from the beginning of 90s, from the beginning of independence. So it became, especially Fergana Valley, which connects three countries throughout the region, Kyrgyzstan part became the center for Hizbut Tahrir, as we know. And, for instance, Tablighi Jamaat is officially, legally operating in Kyrgyzstan, and this movement is banned in all Central Asian countries, also in Russia. So obviously Kyrgyz authorities became more active in fighting, let's say, Islamic radicalization in the country lately. Prime Minister Temir Sariev spoke openly about the growing threat of Islamic radicalization, radical groups. But it's again paradox, because Kyrgyzstan's Grand Mufti represents Tablighi Jamaat, and he openly supports Davatchi movement prayers going from house to house. And so it is becoming more dangerous inside the country, where authorities are becoming more active in fighting against Islamic radicalization. But on the other hand, we have very rapidly growing extremist groups in the country. Even in parliamentary elections, for the first time, we had party which was very quickly created by the Islamic group of people, and they apparently represent Salafi groups in the country. And people not all people realized that they were Islamic Salafi people, very young people. But it means, it's a big signal that Islamic groups, some extremists, some banned in neighboring countries, they are operating very actively in Kyrgyzstan, and they are already trying to interfere into politics.
Right.
And just for the benefit of our audience, could you name that political party?
Ulu Kyrgyzstan, okay. Which means Great Kyrgyzstan.
Yeah, obviously Islamic radicalization turned out to be one of the major stories in Kyrgyzstan. So what is the main story in Uzbekistan, Sirojiddin, or this year?
It is too difficult to mention just one main story, but on the eve of the last year, after Islam Karimov have been re-elected again as a president, stressed that he would continue his policy of stability, territorial integrity, and state control over the economy. The economic situation has worsened. It is the same as all the Central Asian republics. The remittances from Russia and from abroad decreased by 40%, by more than 40%. The unemployment rate is increasing. People are not happy at all, but they don't have platform to increase their voice and to express their concerns. No one is to answer for their hardship, for their questions. The Uzbek government is still highlighting the growth of Islamic extremism, radical groups in the Middle East, especially in Syria and in Afghanistan. And by showing stability, relative stability in the country, they want to stress that, that everything is under the control and people are living happily in one of the secure countries in the world.
Right, and I remember from our editorial meetings, Alisher, director of Uzbek service, was talking about, in several occasions, energy crisis in Uzbekistan. How big story was that?
I was going to mention this issue as well. This is probably the biggest issue that Uzbekistan is facing now. That the country, the most populous country in Central Asia, with a population of more than 30 million, and almost in all regions of Uzbekistan now, we see blackouts. Only 1 hour of electricity is being supplied in the regions. In officially, they say that they cut during the winter time until the beginning of spring. They will cut the supplying of electricity by three times. Hmm. But in fact, if you don't mention Tashkent, all other regions, suburbs, all villages, small towns just don't have enough electricity, and people are suffering a lot. Even there are adverts or stories about young babies being killed because of cold weather, and people stress that they say, please don't put your children into the babies into the cradle because they may die because of the cold. That's the nightmare at the moment for people in Uzbekistan.
Right. I wanted to give a microphone to our Kazakhstan representation.
I'm going to sit in honorary Kazakh for the day.
So yeah, Rus, I'm coming to you. But I believe the energy, the decline of energy prices has been one of the major issues there, which followed with the devaluation of Kazakh tenge. What would you highlight as some of the major stories that happened in 2015?
Well, of course, Kazakhstan had a presidential election at the start of the year. In much as the same case as Uzbekistan, it was pushed forward, and people believed that was so the election would be over before the really bad economic news started to make it to the people. Oil prices coming down. Kazakhstan's been warned for years it had to diversify its economy, and it didn't pay enough attention to that. So we saw the effects almost immediately. They've revised the budget three times this year to reflect the falling price of oil. It went from $60, $50, $40 a barrel. And every time they started to get a new figure, they had to revise the budget again. Kazakhstan across the board has canceled a number of projects, social and other ones that the government was interested in more long term, or certainly reduced them. And like I said, this hit schools, it's hit housing projects. Practically every sector of the society has seen reductions in the amount of government funding that they're going to see this year and next year and for the foreseeable future. So that's been a big problem. Now, of course, the tenge, and I saw that the Kazakh service reported this today, has lost 85% of its value this year.
Oh.
So this is dreadful news for them. Now, not only does that sound horrible to even hear that figure, but you have to remember that a lot of people who have taken out loans in the last few years, and Kazakhstan was doing exceptionally well financially for years and years now. So people have taken out loans recently, and they took them out in dollars. And now they're having to pay them back in tenge. And this is one of those pots that's waiting to boil over, where people all of a sudden cannot pay back the home loans that they have, not at the tenge rate that they have. The Kazakh government has defended the decision, not only saying that they're trying to do whatever they can, but they said, we put this off as long as we could. Nazarbayev made a speech just a couple months ago when they finally let the tenge float freely. That was August. And he said, since the first devaluation, which was in February 2014, the Kazakh Central Bank had spent more than $24 billion trying to prop up the value of the tenge. This year alone, they spent $17.5 billion trying to keep the tenge propped up. And that, so that's essentially between the start of this year and August that they spent that much money trying to keep the Tenge solid. Russia's obviously Russia with the 7,000-kilometer border, main trading partner. This has had a huge effect on Kazakhstan. I'll give you just one example, that Kazakhstan was in the very last phase of modernizing all three of its oil refineries so that they could provide petroleum to their own population. But Russia, since it devalued its currency earlier, Russian petroleum started to come across the border and undersold Kazakh petroleum, and now they've delayed the refinery modernization program, even though there's only 1 year left on modernizing all three of the refineries, because all of a sudden it became economically unfeasible. They're not going to make any money off doing that, so they've slowed these projects way down. And, of course, on top of that, they've had a lot of problems with some of the projects that are already going, Kashagan being the first and foremost, where this was supposed to be the big moneymaker for Kazakhstan. There are various estimates of what the price of oil has to be for that to even be profitable now. And they go from $80 a barrel to $100 a barrel, and those prices aren't going to be seen for many, many years. So they're finally going to start Kashagan maybe at the end of next year, maybe in 2017. But the fact is they'll be running it at a loss for a decade at least before they even make any money back. So it's a pretty grim situation in Kazakhstan.
Right. In terms of devaluation, obviously, each of country has had their own specific issues. When it comes to devaluation of money, the currency, I think it's a kind of shared situation in all of our Central Asian countries. Like if we are talking about Turkmenistan, the Turkmen manat lost into some estimates 23% of its value in 2015. And I just want to a little bit talk about this subject. So the measures that authorities have taken to avoid the its effect to the societies, how it has been, how useful it has been in your country, Sajida, let's start with you.
A very strange way of controlling rate of dollar or jump of dollar against somoni was taken by Tajik officials. They basically blame exchange offices for artificially increase the price of dollar, the rate of dollar against somoni, and central bank decided to close all the exchange offices in Tajikistan and throughout the country, and only banks now have right to offer exchange of dollar, somoni to dollar or dollar to somoni. But it's very hard to find currency now because many people going from one bank to another, and there is no cash available, especially dollar is just disappeared. Many experts believe that the country which does not have any production and cannot sustain its currency, it's very hard to control the rate of dollars against somoni. In fact, Tajikistan does not have big factories or except aluminium plant. You know that the price of aluminium is dropping in the local international market, and Tajikistan cannot did not have revenue from cotton and sale of aluminium. That's why the flow of foreign currency is slow compared to previously years. That's why they train them artificially to avoid dollar from sharp jumping. But many experts believe that nothing would help until Tajikistan would have diversified economy, not only rely on remittances, not only rely on business with Russia, or without having a normal fundament for development of economy.
Right.
It's very hard to improve the situation. I think in terms of economy, Tajikistan would have the same situation in the future, in the nearest future. But from my point of view, the main issue would be security in the future. And the country would sacrifice some achievements that has in the past on just because of stability and security. And you know that, as Bruce mentioned in the beginning of our talk, the ISIS emerged in Afghanistan, and it's gaining actually places in that country. Mm. And it's a direct threat for all countries in Central Asia. You know that Tajikistan has almost 1,300 kilometers with Afghanistan, and some part of this border is very hard to control. That's why the security issue is a priority compared to economy now.
Right. His social situation or the economic situation is also playing out a little bit in hands of those militants. How it is going to affect to the security situation?
No, I can't say that it has a direct impact on security, the economic situation. Of course, the prediction that migration process would slow next year and less migrants from Tajikistan would go to Russia and they basically return to Tajikistan. There is no job and no economy, no money, nothing. It poses some security for domestic issues. So it would be the threat for domestic security rather than global for the region. But so far, as we know, for instance, since last year and the peak of migrants going to Russia, only 800,000 go to Russia, while a year ago it was 1,300,000. So you can imagine that people who left in Tajikistan or returned or deported from Russia all are coming to Tajikistan with no job, and definitely it would be a threat for the stabilization of the country.
Right. In terms of the devaluation of money and its impact and the measures being taken by the national authorities in the countries, what kind of challenge it has been to your country, Venera? One of the main source of the income for the Kyrgyzstan was the remittances, and that was coming from Russia, and Russian ruble fell dramatically, and then you had this devaluation of national currency against dollar. So what kind of measures being taken and how it is being successful or unsuccessful in the country?
We just had recently a very funny story, statement actually from National Bank chairman, who is a young guy, economist, and he made a statement that finally we found the people who were manipulating US dollars, I mean foreign currencies rate, euro dollars rates. So this is a small bank in Bishkek. They have several currency exchange, money exchange offices, and they were manipulating, putting new, like, little bit higher exchange rate, and they were making tons of money, etc. We were laughing that we have to inform very quickly Mr. Putin, so he also will find the people who are guilty for all this
drop
of Russian ruble, etc. So anyway, the National Bank and Kyrgyz government are doing lots of intervention into trying to keep the dollar and euros rate at the level, not making it too high, etc. But it's not working, of course, because in the market economy, all other aspects of economy dictate that situation. And people are very, it's very difficult for people. For instance, livestock and agricultural products prices are falling down sharply.
Right.
For instance, like if one sheep was like 1 year ago, normal good sheep was like $150. Now it's under $100,
right,
which makes farmer's life much harder. He must pay for his kids' university tuition. He must pay bank loans, etc. And everything's very difficult. Remittances, they dropped by 30% officially. But as you know, migrants from Kyrgyzstan didn't return to their country as maybe it happened in Tajikistan, because Kyrgyzstan joined the Eurasian Economic Union, and Kyrgyz migrants got some privileges of living in Russia and in Kazakhstan, and so they are not thinking about returning, even though their incomes dropped very, very sharply. So in everyday life, people are facing lots of difficulties, much more difficulties. They have much less money to spend on their everyday life. So it is becoming a big threat for stability.
When it comes to Turkmenistan, for instance, like we have seen reports coming out from this and that region where companies are no more able to pay salaries of their employees on time or at all. And then some companies which are connected directly to the energy sector are laying off their employees. And then lately, authorities are trying to regulate the exchange rate and having intervention again and again. The last intervention was like an individual, it can buy only $1,000 a month. And that's it's having a huge effect on the minor traders because they need dollar to be able to do their business outside of the country. Uzbekistan, the country of the largest migrant workers, how the effect has been to your country in terms of dollar or the foreign currency?
Of course, the fall of economy in Russia also affected on the lives of ordinary Uzbeks in Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is trying to attract more foreign investors into the huge energy sector by offering good interest conditions to the foreign countries, foreign companies. But having bad experience in the past, the foreign companies are not rushing into Uzbekistan, knowing that there is no convertibility of dollar, mm-hmm. and you have to work and rely on the Uzbek som, which is you cannot freely convert money in exchange offices. You have to have special permission from the government, which in sense will affect on the house markets, the properties especially badly affected as a result of the economic decrease in Russia. Now prices in Tashkent have fallen twice compared to the same period of the last year. Or the more migrants are returning to Uzbekistan and they are unemployed. Most of them are trying to find, you know, any job just to survive. Mm-hmm. And plus, although the prices, food prices decreased because of the domestic production, people simply don't have money. And Uzbek government is saying that they have been creating new jobs every year, almost a million. And they have been stressing this over the 20 years. If you say the population of Uzbekistan is 30 million and then all must be employed, everybody must be employed. But you see, so I have a relative in Uzbekistan and he said that he has two cows and he's unemployed, but the government put him as employed because he has two cows and he has to look after them. That's the reality in Uzbekistan. And plus, recently the prices of the biggest car industry products of the biggest car industry in Uzbekistan has fallen sharply. In Tashkent, in Uzbekistan, there are so many number of cars, new cars, and they're very cheap now. But people don't have money. And they have to think about tuitions, about the paying utility bills, taxes, council taxes, and they just wait now. So they are just waiting for changes, but they don't know what's going to happen. Government is forced to rely on cotton industry as well because it is one of the few the industries which may brought in a cash, hard cash into with the state's budget. Apart from that, the people are so pessimistic that they don't think that the government's policy will change rapidly in the nearest future, because Karimov has been ruling country over quarter centuries, and the same process, the total control of the state, is underway in
right.
Uzbekistan.
So, Rajitan, what number of people are we talking about, the ones who returned from Russia?
So we don't have exact numbers, but people assess that up to 25-30% of labor migrants from Russia, Turkey, and Kazakhstan returned to Uzbekistan. And most of them, many of them were deported by the Russian authorities in order to ease the tense in Russia itself.
Right.
In addition to what Sirojuddin said, as of January, as I mentioned, Russia is going to introduce a patent kind of work permission for migrants. The price is different from one region to another region. In some way, it reaches 40,000 Russian rubles from 25 to 30,000. So it's very hard for migrant who borrows money, for instance, borrows 40,000 rubles to go to Russia. With hope that he can work quickly and return money to a person who gave this money, for instance, in Tajikistan or Uzbekistan. In the current case, they cannot do that because they have to pay 40 1,000 rubles to get the patent for working. This is the main problem now for all migrants. I'm not sure about, because it condition with Kyrgyz are different, is different. But what relates to Tajiks and Uzbeks, they definitely would return to Tajikistan, because no one would. Migrants have no money, 40,000, to get a patent in Russia and to continue work there. This would decrease, further decrease the number of migrants in Russian territory.
If I could just get in one question, too, before we look into the future, I wanted to ask Sarojuddin. Uzbekistan also differs from the other countries that you have a very vibrant black market, and I wish there was a better way to put that. But there's a black market for currency in Uzbekistan that doesn't exist in the other countries. Could you kind of run us through a little bit about the changes in the black market rates over the course of the year?
Yes, the difference is 50%. Let's say it's officially it's around 4,000 ruble, some is $1, but non-officially it's 6,000, some is $1. Imagine people just desperately need dollar in order to keep the economy safe, relatively, but they cannot find it. So it is very difficult for them to get the permission from the government to freely buy the dollar. So now it's a black market, and small traders are playing major role in here. Those who travel abroad, they bring money by different ways, and of course remittances.
Maybe that's why they say in Osh Airport every day dozens of million dollars are being carried on planes.
And now we call it the gypsy transfer. In Uzbekistan, it's called gypsy transfer. In Afghanistan, it's hawala. It is a very safest way of delivering, transferring money from one country to another country
without
commissionings and without handing cash from hand to hand. Now it's increasing. This, for example, in Russia, somebody has somebody, and in Uzbekistan, somebody has somebody. So they just pass money to one. From one hand to another hand. And it started working now in Uzbekistan as well.
And it's a not legalized way of transferring money from one country to the
without,
other country.
By avoiding the taxes, avoiding paperwork, just simple and easiest, safest way, especially for the Uzbek citizens who suffer a lot from the tight control of Uzbek authorities.
Right. I have to mention about the one more major event that took place in Turkmenistan's life this year was also Turkmenistan's decision to switch into biometric passport. Our migrants, the Turkmen migrants, the most of them are in Turkey rather than Russia, and most of them are there illegal, and they were illegal for years and years, and therefore their passports are not anymore a proper document. And now, at the top of that, the government also decided to switch passport from an ordinary to a biometric one. And the only way to get that passport was that you have to travel to country. And when you step on the country with your passport, which is expired and everything, you are not allowed to leave the country again. So it's an estimate. We don't know the exact number, but nearly 40,000 Turkmenistanis are in Turkey, living in a kind of a limbo situation without any document, without any proper documentation. They were already illegal. So this is another major development that I just wanted to mention. And we just want to start the next phase of our discussion that's going to look into the future. But one more aspect of the discussion from 2015 is about the foreign policy or the foreign interest into the region. It looks like a little bit waning. We have not seen any major development, like in terms of bilateral relations between Central Asia and the United States or European Union, although we have seen some foreign leaders are visiting, like Japan, some new actors, that is India. Obviously, the Indian Prime Minister was there. How is that in terms of foreign policy, the interest or the engagement of the international community with Central Asia in, let's say, in your case, Sajida?
In case of Tajikistan, and the Tajik foreign policy, Tajikistan declared the policy of open doors. The country really followed this policy. But lately, it's it seems at least that Tajikistan relies more and more on Russia and China. Of course, Tajikistan keeps good relationship with the United States. They have annual political consultations in Washington. They hold it this year also. Country has good relations with the Europe. But if you say about strategic partnership, definitely Russia and China is in priority.
Right. In case of Kyrgyzstan, was it this year or last year, the decision about Manas?
It was last year.
Oh, last year.
And this year it was a big news in summer when Kyrgyzstan cancelled the cooperation agreement with us from 1993, which gave special status for all U.S. governmental and non-governmental staff and goods coming to Kyrgyzstan. So they are deprived of that status. And Kyrgyz authorities showed as a reason the jailed human rights defender Azimjan Askarov's award given by the U.S. State Department, but many experts believe it was like official reason, but there could be other reasons, including other countries' involvement, etc., pressure. So Kyrgyzstan this year, as I said earlier, moved closer
to Russia,
joining the Eurasian Economic Union and becoming more dependent on Eurasian economic members, of course, first of all, Russia, Kazakhstan, economically, and maybe to some extent politically. So this is the foreign policy.
Very briefly, Srajitin or Bruce, as a representative of Kazakh service here, if anything you want to mention very briefly about the foreign policy.
Foreign policy of Uzbekistan, while Tajikistan says that it has open doors policy, Uzbekistan has got the closed doors policy, which is non-interference into other countries' affairs, as Karimov put it, and not allowing Uzbekistan into, say, allowing other foreign countries' military troops.
So German base is gone from Uzbekistan.
Gone this year, yeah. And not allow in Uzbekistan in the future any more foreign troops. And plus, Uzbekistan says that Karimov stressed it that a few months ago that Uzbekistan will not join any political and military alliances anymore.
Right, right. Bruce, you want to give a kind of general picture of, I mean, with coalition forces withdrawn from Afghanistan, the interest from the Western countries were, like, as you said, waning in Central Asia. At least this is my own observation.
No, I agree with that 100%. And I think that's going to be the trend for a while. You know, we saw even this EU thing yesterday, which was really kind of a bland document. I mean, there wasn't a lot. You know, oh, it's a new era of cooperation. But I looked at it briefly, and I didn't see that there was anything new particularly or any deeper cooperation. I think you're going to see the West reducing its presence in there. Strangely, if I had to guess, I would say that this is probably going to work in Kyrgyzstan's favor later on. They're still, U.S. and Europe are still engaged with the countries that border Afghanistan for security reasons, but I think Kyrgyzstan's election puts it in a different, parliamentary election puts it in a different category. And that seems to be where a good amount of attention is being focused, despite the problems with the U.S. and Kyrgyzstan. Most people acknowledge that that last parliamentary election went pretty well, and this is a big model for, or at least what the West hopes is a model. So it's back to being the island of democracy thing. So I would say that if 5 years down the road, Kyrgyzstan will still be getting the same amount of attention from the West, whereas the other countries probably won't be getting the same amount of attention. And you rightly pointed out that maybe naturally they've gravitated toward the East. We have a lot more interest on the part of Japan, India, Pakistan, and Iran, of course, and we'll get to that in the future, is going to be a new player in the region pretty soon here. Now, let me speak for Kazakhstan real quick so we can do the foreign policy from there. I think as far as the Eurasian Economic Union, there is no better proof that this is going to be a hard sell or that, in fact, it's not working very well at all than Kazakhstan's relationship with Russia within the EU. It's been very, very difficult. Kazakhstan has complained a bunch of times, but this shows the problem that Nazarbayev has balancing. He still meets with Putin, and they still smile and shake hands, but then he goes back to Astana and starts saying that, you know, they've banned us from exporting this, they banned us from exporting that, we didn't get prior warning about any of this stuff. Just today, they banned the export of Kazakh meat from, I think, goats and sheep or something because there's a new disease. So this is something that Kazakhstan just heard, even though they're just meeting. and to discuss the Eurasian Economic Union. So Kazakhstan has its hands full. It's going to have a lot less pressure from the West, certainly, because, like I said, there's kind of a disengagement. I think the biggest problem for Kazakhstan in terms of foreign policy issues is, again, comes back to economics. It's been trying to build itself as a center of the Eurasian crossroads and a place where people meet. They've had the interfaith conferences where they bring people from different religions together. They're having the Expo 2017 to try to show what they've been doing with renewable energy. They have all these conferences. They're not going to be able to sponsor that much, and they won't be able to advertise as much as they have been recently. So Kazakhstan always saw itself as being, as one day becoming like a country that everyone understood what it is and where it is in the world today. And that dream is falling apart for financial reasons right now.
Right. You know, we could have also, discussed the aggressive Russia. It has been a major story over this year, again and again. But we have to move on. Let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will be looking into what kind of impact the events in 2015 are going to have in 2016, and what are the predictions for the future developments and scenarios in the light of these developments that we just spoke. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Majlis. Today we are discussing main developments in Central Asia in 2015, and what does it say to 2016. Joining me in the studio is Sojita Jakhvarova, who is the director of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Tajik service, Winira Jumataiba, director of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Kyrgyz service, Sirojitin Tolibov, broadcaster and Uzbek service of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty, and from Central Newsroom, Bruce Panier, who is editor of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog called Kishlag Awazi. So in the light of the developments we have just discussed, which of those events you would expect to have impact, some of the major impacts or leading impact into 2016? And let's start here again with Bruce, with you.
There's not going to be any let up in the decrease. Oil prices at best will stabilize where they are now. We'll get to Iran in a minute, but certainly Iran coming back onto the world gas and oil markets is going to be a huge obstacle to any increase in the price of either gas or oil in the coming years. So Kazakhstan's going to have a hard problem. You know, strangely, Kazakhstan's in this situation where if you were in any of the other Central Asian countries, as bad as the economy is going to go, you would probably want to still live in Kazakhstan, but the people in Kazakhstan have become accustomed to something different. Because the last 10 years have had, even more than 10 years, have had this amazing economic growth, and they were developing a middle class. And Nazarbayev said just a few weeks ago, he said, well, things aren't as bad as the 90s. You know, well, they're not, but they're not much better. And people have forgotten about the 90s, and they got used to something else.
Yeah.
So it's going to get worse in Kazakhstan for sure. And like I said, the irony of this is that the other people in the other Central Asian countries will look at this and say, half of what you got is still better than what we got. But that's not going to make a whole lot of difference among the residents of Kazakhstan. I think they're going to see this as a government failure. And there's going to be more sacrifices. We saw the central banker lost his job, but he's only the first of many who are going to probably lose their job in the coming months.
In your country, Venera, the main thing we have discussed is about the parliamentary election and the leaning of Kyrgyzstan towards Russia. How do you see it is going forward in 2016?
2016 will be dictated by the upcoming presidential election in 2017. And it will be very politically active field still. We as a journalist covering Kyrgyzstan have no single boring day. There's always something happening. Right today, Kyrgyz government announced that they are withdrawing from the negotiations with Centera, Canadian Centera company, which operates the second largest in Central Asia gold mine, Kumtor. So that makes one-third of Kyrgyz industry. And so we will see. Kumtor will be dictating again the political and economic agenda in the country. And also Eurasian Economic Union is facing big tests in Kyrgyzstan. As I said earlier, it's not working as it was promised for Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyz farmers planted tons and tons of vegetables and fruits, hoping, being excited about importing them easily to Russia and Kazakhstan, and it didn't work that way. They had to throw and dump these tons and tons of their agricultural products. It was a very sad picture. So we will see if Eurasian Economic Union rules and regulations will start working for Kyrgyzstan, then it will give some opportunity for Kyrgyz economy to survive and maybe revive. And so I don't know, this seems like Kyrgyz government is still in negotiations with Russia and Kazakhstan, Belarus, Armenia, how to work, how to make it work for Kyrgyz economy. So we will see if we see real results of those negotiations or not in the near future. And so...
Right. Sajida, I want to let you to make your predictions of the major stories that might be the case in 2016. But one specific, the topic that I'm interested in is, in 2015, you have had the closure of Islamic party in Tajikistan, and there was a crackdown against the opposition. Then you have the security situation. How do you see all these things going forward in 2016?
I think in 2016 the security would be an issue as in late of 2015. Government would strengthen security in the border with Afghanistan, would ask help from other CSTO countries, and government would increase control inside the country, and it would affect media freedom and press freedom in Tajikistan definitely. Because everything, if official would done on behalf of for security, for stabilization or stability, it definitely would affect political freedoms and the media freedom. So I think it definitely would be very tight here for civil society in the country, and all year would be devoted to strengthening security and to save the peace and stability, I would say. It would be the main slogan for the government. In terms of economy, very hard economic year would come in 2016, and Tajikistan would face more economic difficulties. As I mentioned, the country does not have diversified economy, does not have industry. So it basically would rely on the price of aluminium and cotton in the world market to see what brings. I'm not sure that in the future, in the 2016 government would draw more international investment to its economic area or economy energy sector, because it become more political issue, the Ragun Dam and everything. It's very hard. So the only thing, if there would be any improvement in Russian economy, and then it would affect to Tajikistan in a positive way.
Positively, yeah, right. The biggest crisis you mentioned, Sirojuddin, was the remittances and the immigrants who are coming back from Russia. What is your prediction in terms of their options going forward and their impact on overall society in 2016?
The Islam Karimov desperately wants to diversify internal economy by setting up more and more small and medium-sized enterprises, companies, allowing or giving them opportunity, good conditions. But people in Uzbekistan are so skeptic that they do exactly opposite what the government offers to them. If government says that will provide good job opportunities in textile industry, people would stop, or those who work in textile industry just stop or try to find another way of doing business, because they just don't trust the government. That's has been the reality for most of the Uzbeks over the years and years. And they just say, so Uzbek's dish pot has a hole. The dish pot of patience has a hole, and it never fills. So that's the reality. And unfortunately, as Sajida said, the situation is almost similar in Uzbekistan as well. Until the situation in Russia doesn't improve, so we cannot be optimistic that in Uzbekistan, we will see prosperity.
Right. In case of Turkmenistan, I just wanted to mention a few things here. One is the stories which will lead up to 2016 is, one is how this economic situation is going to develop. The second is then just a few days ago, a major project was launched, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline. And the intention by the Turkmen authorities are that it is to be implemented, that the construction to start, and let's see how this is going to end up. And Bruce Panier, let's end up with this question. How the Iran factor my influence to this kind of, let's say, dim picture of Central Asia going forward in 2016? It is certainly an element.
I would. That might actually be one of the few bright lights, and this is strange coming from me, I know, especially as an American citizen, but I'm going to say that Iran, the reentry of Iran into the world community is going to be a huge plus for the Central Asians, and again, maybe one of the only things they have to look forward to in the coming year. It provides them with an entirely new export route, which is stable. You know, Central Asia would love to export through Afghanistan and down into the Gulf and it, you know, and into Pakistan. That's proven absolutely unfeasible for decades in the case of Afghanistan. So that's out of the question. But Iran opening up brings them closer to the Middle East. It brings them closer to the Persian Gulf. It offers a whole new way of a whole new trade route. For trade routes, actually, for the hydrocarbon people, if they can convince Iran to let them ship across their territory, it might open up new doors to Europe besides, which is good news for them. Even simple things, fruits, grains, things like that. And we know Kazakhstan, for instance, is a major grain exporter, and a lot of grain that it's been exporting is to Iran. But this is, you know, with the completion of the railway, the Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan-Iran railway, there's that route too. So, you know, that's something new that they haven't seen. They were pretty much limited to, of course, Russia in the early days. They tried to develop a little bit of trade across the Caspian Sea and through the Caucasus, and that's had some mixed results. China's come on in the last decade, and so now they have an opening route to Eastern Asia. But I think the Iranian reemergence of Iran, like I said, is actually one of the big plus factors. Now, that's in terms of, like, trade cargo and things like that. That of course, that's great. I did mention oil and gas, and I would be remiss if I did not point out that Iran is going to be a competitor for oil and gas exports. So that's a big question about how much cooperation you're going to see. Would they build a pipeline and let Turkmenistan ship gas to Europe? Probably not until they'd been already selling enough of their gas to Europe. And the same is true for oil in Kazakhstan. There's been a lot of gas and certainly oil swaps, between Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan on the one hand and Iran. That will probably go down. But in the meantime, it does open up a new route. Although, as we were saying, talking just before the show started, the gateway to Iran is Turkmenistan.
Right.
So if you're Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, or Tajikistan, you're going to want to have good relations with Turkmenistan because you're going to be dependent upon them to let your cargo go into Iran. So that does change the dynamic of Turkmenistan's role in Central Asia, as well as, of course, Iran's role in Central Asia.
Right. That's in case that prediction goes in the positive direction. It also means that there should be a huge change within the Turkmenistan to let that transport to take place, let that mobilization to take place in the first place in the country. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, for your insightful comments. And also thanks to Sojida Jafarova, who is the director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Tajik service, and Winira Jumataeva, director of the Kyrgyz service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Sirojiddin Talibov, broadcaster of the Uzbek service and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. And this is it from me, Mohamed Tahir, director of the Turkmen service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.